Hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. We have four appeals that are scheduled for oral argument this morning on the court's oral argument calendar. Judge Rosenbaum, Judge Carnes, and I are ready to proceed with the arguments. Ms. Geddes is the courtroom deputy, and she will serve as the timekeeper. And she will let you know when your time to argue has expired. And she will also provide you with a 2-minute warning before your time expires. And so I see that counsel are ready to proceed with the first case. It's the United States of America versus Dean Matthews. And Richard Michael Suma is here for the appellant Matthews. And Jordine Learn, I see that you're working pretty hard this week, Ms. Learn. You're back again for argument for the United States. And Mr. Suma, are you ready to proceed with your argument? And you're on mute, Mr. Suma. You can't, there you go.
May it please the court. I'm Richard Suma. I represent Dean Matthews, the appellant. In the first issue this morning, we argued that the district court erred in enhancing his offense level over objection by making a specific finding that a high capacity magazine was in close proximity to his firearm, to a firearm at the time of the offense. Close proximity is a multi-factor test which evaluates the physical distance between the magazine and the firearm, and also the accessibility of the magazine and the firearm. And I think on this issue, the argument is pretty straightforward because we say there's no record evidence at all of the physical distance between a magazine and a firearm. The court will note the district court did not make any sort of finding of distance, like the magazine was 10 feet or 25 feet or 50 feet away from the firearm. And the court could not make any such finding because there was absolutely no evidence to that effect.
Why would a gun store sell rifles that are capable of using a magazine of 30 rounds without also having magazines of 30 rounds?
Well, they may, but there is no evidence to that effect, or at least there was no evidence as to the location of the firearm, of the magazine. What we have is a statement by a government's witness, and I think acknowledgement by all parties, that the store does not want to have the magazines readily accessible or installed in the firearms when customers are in the store, probably due to safety reasons. I think that's a reasonable inference, but that works against the government because that also suggests that the magazines may have been stored in a different location. They may have been locked up for safety purposes. Yes.
May I ask a question related to that? I'm wondering, it seems to me on this record that there is evidence that your client bought not only the gun, but also that the standard 30 bullet magazine was going to come with it. Am I understanding the record correctly?
There is evidence that in a normal sale, the high capacity magazine comes standard with the gun, but what we're lacking here is no evidence that the standard procedure was to be followed here in this particular purpose.
Is there any evidence that suggests in any way that the standard procedure that's always followed was not going to be followed?
I don't think so, but I don't think that helps the government's position because there has to be some evidentiary proof that the standard procedure would be followed. What we have here is
a question about that. Doesn't the fact that it is the standard procedure provide proof that it would be followed unless there were some kind of an exception that might be available?
No, I think the government had the burden of providing evidence that this particular sale would have involved a high capacity magazine, and that was not done.
Counsel, what difference would it make to your case? I don't understand why you're ceding some premises. What difference would it make to your case if, when the sale went through, the magazine was joined with the rifle? I mean, even if there was a stipulation that if the sale had gone through, they would have told him, "We'll meet us at the side door. We'll put the clip in the rifle for you, show you how it works, and off you go."
Well,
the crime was committed here. We made the false statements on the form, not whether. And there's no standard procedure that at the time you fill out the form, the magazine and the rifle are together. Your argument ought to be the crime was committed before the standard procedure would have gone into effect.
Well, that's true. I believe I did argue that in the briefs, and I'll get to that now, because as the judge, the district court agreed with the defense counsel that the close proximity has to be judged at the time of the offense. And I think that's correct. That's specifically stated in the commentary to the guideline. And at that point, there was no evidence of the location of the magazine or the distance between the magazine and the firearm. And anticipating the government's argument that had the sale been somehow completed, that would be relevant conduct. I believe that to be incorrect, because relevant conduct is a factual finding which has to be made by the district court. And that finding was not made because the district court recognized that the standard has to be at the time of the offense. And also, if you look at the definition of harm in the guidelines, harm includes bodily injury, monetary loss, property damage, and any resulting harm. Resulting harm means actual harm that occurred, and which did not happen in this case because the sale was never completed. So we never did get to close proximity. So that's basically our argument on the first issue. If there are no other questions, I'll move. One more thing I would like to add. There was a lot of discussion at the sentencing hearing and in the briefs about a form 44473. And I think the government wants to argue that there's some intimation in that form that the defendant acknowledged he wanted a high capacity magazine, but that form was never introduced into evidence. So there's that argument doesn't help the government. Turning to issue two, if there are no other questions, issue two is a very, very interesting issue, I think. We argued that the district court erred in enhancing the offense level by finding a prior conviction for a crime of violence, and the crime is Florida felony battery. And of course, this is the same battery that was at the same crime that was at issue in the Vail Belnon en banc decision, where the court held that Florida felony battery necessarily requires use of force capable of causing physical pain or injury. But in that case, in the discussion of least culpable conduct, the en banc court said that Mr. Belnon failed to show a realistic probability that the statute would be applied to conduct outside the qualifying definition of a predicate crime. And the qualifying definition here is the elements clause. This case is in direct contrast to Vail Belnon, because here Mr. Matthews can show and did show that as to him, this felony battery statute was applied to conduct not amounting to use of force capable of causing physical pain or injury. And Mr. Matthews was allowed and permitted to do that, to make that proof, under both Vail Belnon and the Supreme Court's Duenas-Alvarez case. Those cases say that when the focus is on the least culpable conduct, the defendant can go outside the statute now and refer to possibly other decisions of the state court, which show the statute was applied more broadly. And most specifically, he may show that the statute was so applied in his own case, applied more broadly in his own case. Those statutes give the authority to the defendant to introduce evidence of the particular conduct in his own case that resulted in a felony battery conviction.
I thought Val Belmont held, specifically held, that the crime was categorically a crime of violence and that you couldn't be convicted of it unless the force element was present.
That is a correct assessment of the holding, but the holding is also in the context of the fact that the court considered the doctrine of the least culpable conduct and found—
I understand that, but it said you can't be the least culpable conduct that you have to be shown to have committed for this crime categorically as present, or you would not have been convicted of this crime.
That's true, but the court also said that this defendant also failed to show in his own case—
Counsel, 2 minute warning.
Thank you. Also failed to show in his own case that the statute could be applied to conduct which is broader than the elements clause.
But that wasn't part of the holding. That was an observation, not part of the holding.
Yes, but the holding of any case is limited to the facts presented in this case. And what we're presenting to you here is a case with different facts, which was
not— whenever we say we hold the following in this circumstance and this crime, you say that if some future defendant can come up and say, my crime was different.
Yes.
I know the court sitting en banc specifically held that I could not have been convicted of this crime unless I was found guilty by a jury of the force element or pled to it. But that's wrong. I was. That's your position.
Yes, we can show an exception to that.
So every case that follows a holding of this court can collaterally attack the holding of the court and say that was wrong.
Well, we're not actually challenging Val Belmont.
You are, because Val Belmont said you can't be convicted of this without somebody having found beyond reasonable doubt or through a plea that you were guilty of the force element. And you're saying, yes, you can. And my client's case shows that.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll come back. I may be out of time, but if I'm granted time, I'll come back on rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Lauren.
Good morning. May it please the court. This is Assistant United States Attorney Jordan Lauren on behalf of the United States. Unless the court prefers otherwise, I'm going to start with the firearm issue. I think the problem with Mr. Matthews' argument is he focuses too much on the relationship between the defendant and the items in this case being the firearm and the magazine, and not what the primary focus should be, which is on the relationship between the firearm and the magazine itself. I think that's pretty much what the Gordillo case holds. It's about whether or not there's a close or clear connection between those two items.
And but there has to be also a connection to the firearm in relation to the defendant. If, for example, there was a stipulation later, for whatever reason, that at Mike's gun store number 2 across town, the magazines were loaded into the rifle, and this defendant went to a gun store where that wasn't the case, that wouldn't prove the element. So it has to be that he's going to get a rifle, or he's going to be given a rifle, or he's trying to get a rifle in which there is close proximity with the magazine. Right?
No, I agree fully with Your Honor, but I think that's what the evidence in this case shows. He filled out the form with the intent to obtain a particular rifle. that came standard with the high capacity magazine. That's what our evidence shows, and that's exactly
what. But also it is standard that it would not come while he was in the gun store with the high capacity magazine. And there's no evidence as to where the high capacity magazines were kept. Far as we know, he might be told to go somewhere else and get one, or come back in 20 days and we'll give you one. We don't know. Do we? I mean, how do we know that?
Well, I think you can infer from Agent Evans' testimony. She did say that they review everything that comes with the firearm, and part of that standard package included the magazine. I also think
we know it doesn't come with the firearm at the time the crime is committed.
I think what Your Honor is getting at is the accessibility. Am I correct about between relationship between the firearm?
No, what I'm getting at is the close proximity of the high capacity magazine to the rifle at the time the crime is committed. And the time the crime was committed, I'm sure you agree, was when he filled out or signed the form to purchase it and lied.
I agree with that, Your Honor, but I think it has to be considered in the context of what this offense was, which was filling out the form with the intent to obtain a particular firearm that comes standard with the high capacity magazine. And so I think the offense is more broadly construed than just the exact moment when you fill out the paperwork. The fact of the matter is he's not going to get the firearm or the magazine until the paperwork is processed. It doesn't mean his offense did not involve a firearm with a high capacity magazine. The nature of this very offense was that. It's just, this is unlike, you know, we don't have a possession case. So this guideline covers a wide range of firearm offenses. And so I think it needs to be considered in the context of what this offense was, which is the false statement on the form. And in that case, or in this case, you know, close proximity. And I think Gordillo is instructive. It's just Gordillo is a possession case, so we need to consider it in the context of this case and how those principles would translate to this sort of crime. Or I think the fact would be that no 922A6 offense would ever qualify for the enhanced base offense level. And I don't think that's what the plain language of the guidelines.
Well, it would if a gun store sold the rifle with the high capacity magazine attached. Your argument seems to be Mike's gun store would never allow us to get this enhancement because they take precautions that keep the magazine away from the rifle at the time the defendants or prospective defendants are committing the crime. We don't say to make this enhancement applicable, this is what we need to hold. We look at the standard, which is in the application note, and say, is it met? And if it's not met, the fact that the government can't make it applicable in a broad range of factual situations is not really a relevant consideration.
Well, what I would say to Your Honor is I think the evidence shows that the firearm is sold with the magazine. The evidence
he wasn't charged with purchasing the firearm, was he?
No, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, then the question is, does it come with a high-capacity magazine? Is it going to be in close proximity at the time he commits the crime? Isn't it? Isn't that what the application note clearly means?
No, I agree with Your Honor, but I think and our position is that the crime should be construed more broadly than just signing your name and submitting the form. And I think
really? So if he gets in the courtroom and the defendant says, look, you got to construe this crime broadly. You ought to construe it to mean I was buying this to go commit mass murder. That's how you ought to construe it. Your responsibility, oh, no. The elements are clearly set out in the code. And your elements are clearly set out in the code for the present circumstances, aren't they?
No, I agree, but I think the relevant, so offense includes relevant conduct, and relevant conduct is much broader than just the act of signing the form. And it, as we noted in our brief, it also includes the harm that's the object of the offense. And in this case, the harm that was the object of submitting the false statement was the defendant ultimately obtaining the rifle, but also the firearm that comes standard with it.
Did he fill out the form at the gun store? Where was the form filled out?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that that's clear in the record. I believe it was at the gun store, but I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you. But at the end of the day, I do think the focus on what the harm was that was subject of this offense, filling out the form, remains that it was for a specific firearm that comes standard with a high capacity magazine.
So the purpose for filling out the form was to obtain a rifle that is capable of accepting a large capacity magazine. Is that correct?
Yes, I would agree with that. And therefore,
that's the crime, but that's not the enhancement. The enhancement, you can be every one of these rifles that are sold are capable of that. But the enhancement doesn't apply every time someone buys one of these rifles. You go to a gun show and buy one of these rifles, and the guy says, "I'm sorry, I don't have any magazines. They're a hot commodity item, but I can sell you the rifle." You don't get the enhancement. Do you?
Does the enhancement apply, counsel, when you purchase the gun that is capable of firing off 30 rounds if the magazine is in close proximity to the rifle?
I would say no, Your Honor, absent some evidence that the defendant intends to obtain both those items together. Under Gordillo, the question is there a close connection? And so in theory, you could go to a gun store and buy a firearm that's capable of possessing, or yeah, possess or of capable of, you know, working with a magazine, a high capacity magazine. It doesn't mean that you intend to, there's no accessibility there, right? There's no intent to have those items, right, and use them together.
I understand that. Of course, you know, why would you buy a semi-automatic rifle that's capable of firing off 30 rounds if you don't want to have a magazine? Why would you buy a rifle that's capable of doing that if you're not intend to use it for that purpose? But I thought that the issue here is whether or not when he purchased the rifle, should the enhancement apply because he purchased a rifle that is capable of having a magazine, of having a magazine that fires off 30 rounds, and the magazine is in close proximity to the rifle. That's not the issue here.
No, I agree with Your Honor. That's exactly the issue.
Okay. At the time of the offense.
Right. At the time that he signed the form, right?
No, that's correct. That's exactly the way the government views the evidence.
That's why he was in the gun store. That's why he signed the form, to purchase the rifle, right, counsel?
No, that's correct. It's to purchase the rifle, and we know from the government's evidence the rifle comes standard with that magazine.
Well, just to be clear, Judge Wilson had asked you previously if you filled out the form in the gun store, and I thought you said you were not sure, but my understanding of the record is that he did fill out the form in the gun store. I don't know, are you saying that's not correct? Or
that's, just to be clear, that's consistent with my recollection of the record. Yes, Your Honor.
Talk to us about the firearms checklist that Evans testified about.
Sure. So she testified that checklist, I believe, was a routine part of the process, and that it contained everything that would be the defendant would be receiving with the firearm. I believe there's also testimony that there's confirmation that the firearm was functioning properly. I think she said that when this process goes on, the defendants usually handle the weapon with the store employees to make sure that it's working properly. I don't think there was any specific testimony that process included the magazine necessarily, although I do think you can make a reasonable inference that if you're checking to make sure that the rifle is functional, that you're probably going to also be accessing at the same time the magazine that comes standard with it, although I don't think the district court made that finding.
So you're saying the checklist did not include a high capacity magazine?
No, Your Honor. I think the checklist did include the high capacity magazine.
Why do you think that?
Because Agent Evans testified that the checklist includes everything that comes with the rifle for that process.
You can always circular reason back around to the conclusion you want, but we don't know if that gun store had those magazines in its inventory at that time, or whether it only gave those on certain circumstances. And as far as I can tell, we don't know for sure what the checklist included because the government didn't put it into evidence. And why is that?
Why didn't the government put it into evidence? Is that your question?
Yes.
To be honest,
what could be more relevant than that?
I don't disagree that the firearms checklist would absolutely be helpful. I can't say, represent to the court why that wasn't put into evidence. I do think the district court can make a reasonable inference that a firearm that is sold standard with a magazine that is sold in store is also kept in store. Thank you, Ms. Geddes. Is also stored with it, kept in inventory in the same store. I don't think there's any indication in the record that this would be an exceptional circumstance, that it wouldn't be kept in inventory in the store. So I do think you can make that reasonable inference here. And then, as I recall Agent Evans' testimony, the checklist process would have included reviewing with the defendant everything that would have come with the rifle, which would have included the standard magazine. And I want to clarify my earlier statement. I want to be clear that I'm not sure that the evidence indicates the process would have included physically manipulating those items, but I do think Agent Evans' testimony indicates that what would be coming with the rifle, what he would receive if his form was approved, and when he arrives to pick up the items, ultimately, that process does include reviewing what he will be receiving, which includes the standard magazine.
We don't know whether that checklist said a 30-shot clip or 30-shot magazine, or it just simply said magazine, do we? We don't know.
I don't disagree.
The reason we don't know is the government didn't put the document into evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I don't understand why we have to speculate when the government had the means of proof and chose or neglected to use them.
Well, I would just refer back. I guess the government's view at sentencing was that Agent Evans' testimony was sufficient. I think she was pretty clear that.
My view, for what it's worth, and I speak only for myself, is that it wasn't sufficient, particularly when it would not have taken more than 60 seconds.
I understand, Your Honor.
For us to know one way or the other.
And I see my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, let's learn. Your argument, as I understand it, is that the government is relying upon Ms. Evans' testimony that the firearms generally do not have the magazines in them when people are looking at them at the store. Is that understanding correct or incorrect?
No, I think that's correct, and that's exactly what she testified to. But I think the inference that can be drawn from that testimony is that the magazines are kept in the store. And I think that inference could also be drawn just from her testimony that it comes standard with a rifle that is stored in the store.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Summa, you've reserved some time for rebuttal.
You're on mute, Mr. Summa.
Mr. Summa, you're still on mute. There you are.
I got it. Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to clarify our position here on issue two. We think that under the Duenas-Alvarez case of the United States Supreme Court, every defendant has an opportunity to show that a statute was applied in his own case to conduct that is more broad than the qualifying definition of the predicate crime.
And he can put in hearing evidence, call witness, say this is what he did in that crime. And the government can call responsive witnesses, say, no, he actually hit the lady over the head with a pipe.
I don't know. I don't know the breadth of the testimony that he can do. I think he certainly can rely on the documents that he supplied in this case. And I thank you very much.
Counsel, let me ask you a question related to that. My argument is basically that an assumption that the veil bail on court made, that is, that it's not possible to commit this offense without civil force, right, is invalid, right? That's your argument. But that assumption is invalid. That's really what it
is. I did argue that in our what I call my third issue. If you follow the theory that you only need one exception to disprove a rule, then yes. But in the alternative,
well let me tell you what the problem is. So first of all, I agree with you, but I was outvoted on that. So we now have a holding that is based on that assumption that it's not possible to commit that offense without engaging in physical violence. And it's en banc, and we're bound by it. Especially because we've said it's categorically a crime of violence. It seems to me like your only remedy would be for us to reconsider it en banc. Why is that not the case?
That's not the case, because part of the en banc court reasoning in Valbelnon is that when it considered the least culpable conduct, it decided that that particular defendant could not show the realistic probability that the statute was applied more broadly in any case.
So your position is that the court went all the trouble, effort, and time to reach a decision en banc that is applicable to only one case?
I think it's a decision that's generally applicable, but there may be exceptions because the Supreme Court gives every defendant under Duenas-Alvarez the opportunity to show that the statute was applied in exceptional manner in his particular case, and that is what we proved in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Suma, Ms. Lauren.